Welcome to a series of podcasts brought to you by the Yale Law School.
A chief architect of South Africa's post-apartheid constitution, Justice Albie Sachs, was appointed by Nelson Mandela in 1994 to serve on the country's newly established constitutional court, where he served until his retirement in 2009. The appointment followed decades of anti-apartheid activism, during which Sachs was raided by the security police, subjected to banning orders restricting his movement, and twice detained in solitary confinement without trial for prolonged periods. He eventually went into exile, spending 11 years studying and teaching law in England and another 11 years in Mozambique, where he worked as a law professor and legal researcher. In 1988, he was the target of a car bombing by South African security agents, which cost him his right arm and sight in one eye. His newest book, The Strange Alchemy of Life and Law, was published by Oxford University Press in August of 2009.
I was 39 years old, quietly teaching law as an exiled law professor at Southampton University when I discovered I was a terrorist. The knowledge came to me when I sought to come to the United States of America, 1974, to attend a conference organized by the Yale History Department at a place called Mount Kisco, if I remember correctly, on contemporary developments in Southern Africa. And because I belonged to the ANC, headed by that well-known terrorist Nelson Mandela, I was automatically on the list of terrorists. Fortunately for me, the lobby group in Washington, siding with the anti-apartheid forces, turned out to be stronger than the lobby group in Washington siding with the South African government. So Monday I was a terrorist. Tuesday I was no longer a terrorist. It wasn't simply that the word was ignoble. To be a terrorist in South Africa had consequences. Thousands of us were plucked off the streets, out of our homes, going to work, and found ourselves in jail in solitary confinement. And being a lawyer didn't exempt me from that process. It was 1st of October, which is the spring day in South Africa. I remember I was still wearing a fairly heavy suit. It was a chilly day. And as I was about to enter the building where my chambers were, suddenly, like you see in the movies, a cop reading a newspaper, somebody polishing a car window. Suddenly they stopped what they were doing. They converged on me, about six of them. And the next thing I knew, I was in solitary confinement. No charge. Any police officer above a certain rank had the authority, if they suspected that I had information about terrorism and other things, to place me in solitary confinement, to keep me there for 90 days. So this is what it's like. Goes through my head as I'm standing in this little concrete cube. So this is what it's like. And you sit on the floor and you stare at your toes. You stare at the wall. You stare at the wall, you stare at your toes. At the wall, at your toes. And maybe 5 minutes have passed. And again, there's no one to speak to. There's no activity. You abstracted from the world of society of human beings, and you're just alone. I would invent activities to give myself a sense of being alive and being a person. And one of the first was to go through to try and remember the number of states in the United States of America. And I would start with A, Alabama, we used to say Arkansas, Arizona, and I knew it was around about 50. I didn't know if it was 48 or 49 or 50 or somewhere around there. I couldn't write down the names. I had 10 fingers then, so at least I could get up to maybe at about F and the 10th before starting all over again. I think the best I did was up to about 47. I won't mention the name of the three states that I couldn't recall. And then I would sing, go through the alphabet, always, because, Charmaine. It would be quite a good recall of the hit tunes of October 1963, usually reaching South Africa with a six-month delay. Daisy. I remember having a problem with X, so I cheated a bit deep in the heart of Texas. And my favorite was always, I'll be living here, always, year after year, always, in this little cell that I know so well, I'll be living swell, always, always. And then I would twirl around and feel in my deep depression at least traces of amusement that this Irving Berlin song picked up by Noel Coward in a comedy of upper middle class manners was keeping a young radical in South Africa, giving him some fighting spirit. I'll be staying in always, keeping up my chin always, not for but an hour, not for but a week, not for 90 days, but always. The 90th day comes, the police officer comes to me and says, you're being released. I'm very suspicious. I've been marking off the days on the wall like good prisoners supposed to be. And I go down the stairs. I was in a tiny cell upstairs at that stage. I'm given back my tie. I'm given back my watch. The station commander says, you're free. Am I really free? You're really free. I'm still suspicious. I'm walking towards the door and I see one of the main interrogators coming towards me. He puts out his hand, shakes my hand and says, I'm placing you under arrest. This is something from England. You're supposed to touch the body of the person you're arresting. That was his way of doing it. So they take my tie away again, my watch. I go up the stairs and another session starts. You don't know for how long it is. Eventually, after another 78 days, I was released as suddenly as I'd been picked up. I never found out why I'd been detained. I never found out why I was being released. I was so overjoyed that I clothed myself and I ran from the center of Cape Town to the nearest beach, which was about 10 miles away. I'd never run any distance like that in my life, and flung myself into the waves with sheer euphoria. But 2 years later, I was inside again. And you don't get stronger each time you picked up. And this time a team had come down from Johannesburg, headed by the famous, stroke notorious, Rooirus Swanepoel, who disdained the Cape Town security people for having been too soft. And sitting at a chair, and they bang the table for 10 minutes, terrible din, and then just quiet for 50. And another 10 minutes, then I slowly realize this is the pattern, and it goes on through the afternoon, through the evening. I'm given something to eat, and I see a little smirk on their face, and I realize afterwards there was something in that food. And this information came out afterwards to weaken your will. and past midnight and into the early hours of the morning, and I'm getting weaker and weaker, and the fatigue is overwhelming, and my body is just craving for sleep, and it's fighting my will and destroying any sense of autonomy I might have. And I knew that clients of mine had resisted for 1 day, 2 days, 3 days. The longer they resisted, the more they collapsed at the end and broke completely. And slowly I start saying to myself, I'm not going to be able to withstand this. At least I must try and manage my breakdown. And I sit for a few more hours and I collapse. They've been working in relays, noise, quiet, noise, quiet, noise, quiet, through the night. And I see the shoes running around, black shoes and brown shoes. I hear the voices. And water pours down, and I'm closing my eyes. They lift me up, and Rorus's fingers, thick, heavy fingers, pushing my eyes open. I'm on the chair. I collapse again. I'm not sure if it was 2, 3, 4 times. Eventually, I'm sitting on the chair, and eventually something in me breaks, a controlled break, but a break. It's the worst moment of my life by far, far worse than being blown up by the bomb. The bomb is an attack on your body. This is an attack on your dignity, on your spirit, on your sense of self, of autonomy, of your will. It's permanent, and there's a legacy of sadness that remains within me and will be until I die. Multiply the story by 1,000 and 10,000 and add electric shock treatment and standing on bricks. This is what it meant to be called a terrorist in South Africa. It just destroyed any fabric of legality, of rule of law, of due process. Eventually people would be brought to court, but the people really deciding on guilt were not the judges, who had maybe the last word at the end, but the security police. And they would line up the witnesses and process all the witnesses in that same way. And the whole of our criminal procedure, everything that had been designed to prevent abuse, to ensure the trials were fair, even in apartheid racist South Africa, was completely overturned. And it started with the 90-day law. And of course, then I'm detained for another 90 days. And eventually they didn't even limit it to 90 days. The security police, once they get that breakthrough from the ordinary rule of law, it's never enough. They always need just that little bit more. Then we will break them. Part of the irony of that label was that the ANC was anti-terrorist. This was the era of isms, capitalism, socialism, communism, Trotskyism, Stalinism. From China we got mountaintopism. There were lots of isms. And one of the negative isms was, in our struggle, was terrorism. Don't call me that. It was seen as a violation of central tenets of the ANC philosophy of struggle. At times there was extreme pressure on the leadership. When the Black September movement was hijacking aeroplanes, I think the late 60s, early 70s, some of our members were saying, what's the matter with the leadership? They getting headlines, everybody's talking about their struggle, nobody's interested in South Africa, we're just too timid, we're scared to do these things because they're not nice. I remember a conference in 1985 where the issue surfaced again in a small town called Kabwe in Zambia. It was an ANC conference, very important decision-making conference. The building we were in was surrounded by Zambian troops in case South African commandos came to take out the whole leadership core of the ANC. And amongst the things we were discussing was the strategy. And a king, traditional leader, King Sabata Dalinyebo. We called him Comrade King, a patriotic traditional leader who'd been forced into exile because he refused to play the game of apartheid and establish Bantustans in his areas. He went up onto the platform and he addressed the delegates in Xhosa, African language. And when he finished, the majority of the delegates laughed, and the few of us culturally backward, because in a country like South Africa, the oppressed had to learn the language of the oppressors. The oppressors didn't have to learn the language of the oppressed. We had to wait until the interpretation was complete. And he told a story. Two men are fighting. They're really angry with each other, and their wives are egging them on. And the wife of man A says, "My husband, you know you are stronger than B. But he is beating you up. It's because you are using a stick in one hand and you're using your other hand to hold up a blanket to hide your nakedness. Drop the damn blanket and smash him up with both arms and then you'll win." And that's when the people laughed. And when it was translated, that's when we laughed a little bit feebly, a minute or two later. And what he was saying was that the ANC is imposing restrictions on its capacity to fight back. And some people were saying, until the whites bury their children, until they feel the pain in their bodies that we feel, we African people feel, they will never let go and relinquish power. But the conference rejected that approach completely. If I'd been in a position to speak on that particular issue, would have jumped up and said, this is not the traditional philosophical position adopted by the ANC, blah, 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 blah. The African way was to hear the king out, to laugh quietly, "We've heard what you said," and just to carry on with the traditional approach. Far less conflictual, far less polemical. These were well-established principles. And it's important, I think, looking back, to understand why the ANC was so against terrorism, partly for simple tactical presentational reasons. The supporters of apartheid were saying that if the blacks take over, they will just destroy everything, drive the whites into the sea. "We think the whites have behaved very badly, but they have real fears, and you've got to understand their fears, and the new constitutional order, such as it is, must take account of their fears and have special protections for them." This would have played into the hands of that whole approach and been the enemy of non-racial democracy. But the reasoning was much deeper than that. I was very close to Oliver Tambo, whose name deserves to be up there together with Nelson Mandela. Ironically, Mandela, silenced in prison, has become iconic, and Oliver Tambo, campaigning all over the world, nonstop, outside of prison, is virtually unknown. Even in South Africa, we have an airport named after him. Vanessa and I, we had a child 3 years ago, so we've named the child, I joke, after the airport. But he's virtually unknown. I worked very closely with him in those years of exile. And I knew what his philosophy was. It wasn't simply that this indiscriminate attacks on airplanes, who knows who's flying in those airplanes? He could be in one of those planes. And it could be destroying people who are actually sympathetic to our cause. It was much deeper than that. And I'm sure, convinced, the basic reason wasn't even the damage it does to your cause, because there were lots of things we did that were unpopular internationally. Many people told us, abandon the armed struggle, just have purely nonviolent resistance. We carried on the armed struggle as an element of the struggle against apartheid that gave no rights, no voting rights, no rights to protest, no legitimate democratic means whatsoever. You had to fight back somehow. But the main consideration for people like Oliver Tambo is, what does it do to you? What does it do to you? will you become a pure instrument of death? The ANC would lose its own humanity, its own core set of values. And the same theme came out when, at that same conference, with Zambian troops surrounding the delegates there, we had to consider what to do, how to treat captured enemy personnel sent to destroy the organization. I'd been invited by Oliver Tambo to move from Maputo, when I was then working in Mozambique, to travel up, if I could, to Lusaka. He said he had an important matter to discuss. And come to his office, and African Way, he asks after me and my health and the political situation. And I'm wondering, come to it, what's it all about? And eventually he said, we have a problem. We've captured a number of people sent by Pretoria to create mayhem inside the ANC. It wasn't political dissidents. These were real people there, and if you need testimony to the fact that bombs were being used, poison was used, all sorts of methods were used to try and create chaos inside the ANC. And we don't have any regulations. The ANC constitution doesn't say, what do you do with captured prisoners? I imagine the Democratic Party doesn't have a clause. Some people might wish they did. Even the Watergate burglars weren't seized by the Democratic Party. It was the regular police who did that. And he said, it's very difficult. What does one do? And I said, well, the standards aren't difficult. The international instruments that say no torture or inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment. He said, we use torture, with a bleak face. I was stunned. We're fighting for freedom, we use torture. It turned out afterwards that in the camps in Angola, where a civil war was raging, these agents had been caught. The young students who'd left the country, South Africa, to fight for freedom were now the prison guards. They were 19, 20, 21, no training at all. And what did they do? They beat up the prisoners and they treated them abominably. And there'd been, the story had got out. It turned out that Oliver Tambo had sent a commission of inquiry, had interviewed people and determined that there was a very strong prima facie case, that in fact the ANC was using torture. What to do about it? And I was briefed to write what in effect was a code of criminal procedure and criminal law, complete, for a liberation movement living in exile without all the apparatus of a state, that had to be totally contextualized, but based on principles of elementary fairness and justice. And so the code was based on the idea of, you've got your person who comes drunk to a branch meeting and insults the chair and so on. You don't use the equivalent of criminal law. You've got to, the branch itself must handle that. Then you've got the person who stabs someone else or assaults somebody else or drives a vehicle of the ANC who's drunk or steals from the organization. Serious things, but not as serious as those sent in the agents. So we had three tiers of and three modalities and tribunals at the middle level and special tribunals with an appeal, with a presentation of the evidence, the right to challenge the evidence, the right to have a defender, all being appointed from inside the ranks of the ANC. Everybody accepted, this is what we want. The one question was, can intensive methods of interrogation, was the euphemism used, be employed in the case of extreme circumstances? I was wondering how the conference would come out. One by one, the delegates went up. The first were some young soldiers. I didn't even know their real names. Maybe they died afterwards in battle. And this one chap went up and he said, we are fighting for life. how can we be against life? It was so moving. I was so thrilled. It's easy for me. I'm from a comfortable background, a white lawyer. Okay, I'm in the struggle. But, you know, this is my ideology and outlook. Here was somebody facing death, but seeing it as something constitutive of why they were fighting, who we were, what it was all about. One by one, the delegates said the same. And they said, you just give the slightest margin to security and they will use it. There must be an implacable no torture. And so the ANC, 1985, in exile, in very difficult circumstances, being bombed, people being kidnapped and assassinated, being blown up, fighting a heavy struggle inside South Africa, took the decision on principle, no torture, full stop. The reason we have a country today was because of those decisions. It's called the miracle of Mandela. Mandela represents beautifully that philosophy, and you'll see it being carried through in the post-democratic or in the democratic era in this film Invictus. It's not made up. It's factually true. Some of the dialogue might have been reconstructed, but that was a spirit that had already emerged in the struggle days. We want to make a country for everybody. And the minute we start randomly killing people because they are who they are, white or call them the oppressors or whatever you will, you won't get a country. You can reconstruct the buildings and the universities and the schools and the hospitals. You can't reconstruct the spirit of people who are feel they've been savaged and been targeted and losing their humanity through fear because of the loss of humanity of those targeting them and trying to kill them. We had a Bill of Rights before we got a Bill of Rights. It was a Bill of Rights in effect of a liberation movement in exile. To complete the tale of terrorism and torture, I was never in the armed struggle. I supported it, although I'm as close to being a pacifist as you can get without ultimately forbidding the use of violence in any circumstances. I supported it. But I never took part in it. I was a talker. I'm still a talker. My friend Dennis Goldberg, he was a doer. He would fix the sound system for fundraising parties we had. You laugh at that. You start with the sound system, you end up in the underground guerrilla outfits because he could do things. He spent 23 years in Pretoria Central Prison. I didn't go to the armed struggle. The armed struggle came to me. The bomb put in my car. And I mention that because state terrorism has accounted for more loss of life by far than the terrorism of irregular groups. Serious and catastrophic and horrible though those attacks have been. You think of Argentina, you think of Chile, you think of armies, state armies throughout the world who've massacred populations to terrorize them, demonizing those who are destroyed, and that comes from the state, not only with the superior weaponry of the state, but with the capacity for covering up and for disinformation and so on, and that has to be part of the equation. None of that justifies terrorism by people who claim to be fighting for freedom at all, and that was what distinguished our struggle. And enabled us eventually to win over enormous support, to isolate those opposed to us, and to get the democracy that we've got today. Well, the story moves forward now. Sachs J, that's Justice Albie Sachs of the Constitutional Court of South Africa, now wearing a green robe and sitting up with 10 colleagues. It's a bench of 11. We all sit in all cases. A quorum is 8. And we're hearing cases dealing with terrorism and torture. And the question, one of the questions I ask in this book is, to what extent do life experiences enter into one's decision-making as a judge? Intensely subjective personal experiences that partly make you who you are, and you're doing the most objective work possible. Once the judgment's out, it's not yours anymore. It's out there. We call it judgment, the opinion. It's delivered. It's on paper. You can't even correct it unless there are a few patent errors that you can correct very, very quickly. And then it belongs to whoever's interested. And you guys can pick it up and sprinkle it with rose water. You can tear it to shreds. You can do what you like. It's got an objective existence. The words have to mean what they mean. They're out there. And your enterprise is a public enterprise. It's not just a memoir, a recall of some interesting things. It's not reflections. It has consequences. It has effect. It impacts on the lives of people. It's objective. And you're working with your colleagues. What's the connection between the two? And reading about the nomination of Sonia Sotomayor brought back to me all the thoughts that were passing through my mind as I was writing this book. Does the fact that you might be a wise Latina woman with a working class background, is it relevant at all to your work on the effectively constitutional court? And the answer I come to is, it is and it isn't. It comes through powerfully, but often in unexpected ways. There are 11 of us. We've all had totally different experiences. Undoubtedly, what matters is you bring to the table something special. You add to the texture. It doesn't indicate outcomes, your life experience. But it does invest the debate and the dialogue with a texture and a tonality and a significance that otherwise mightn't be there. And I remember hearing from Harry Blackman, whom I met at Aspen Seminar once, and then he kindly hosted me, how important Thurgood Marshall had been on the court. Not only in the legal reasoning and argumentation, but just throwing in an appropriate story, a little aside. They're discussing the founding fathers of the Constitution, and he said, well, if his forefathers had been there, they would have been wearing breeches and carrying trays. Just a little image like that is just very, very telling. But it's not even just the anecdotal. It's the ability to understand the impact that your decisions will have on those affected by it. And of course, that's where Brennan was so powerful. And so that sense of empathy is fundamental. And the way it allies itself to reason. And I always have the image of a wrestling match between them, because reasoning is tough and it's implacable. But empathy, passion, sympathy, call it what you will, is irresistible. And so you've got this irresistible force of empathy meeting the immovable force of reason. And what is that abstract metaphysical question becomes something that happens in your head while you're working, and you don't separate out the two in that way. They're constantly interacting. Anyhow, so we get the case of Dr. Besson comes to the court. Dr. Death, the public call him. Head of bacteriological chemical warfare in the apartheid military. And he's charged with having administered an asphyxiating agent to about 200 captives from SWAPO, Southwest Africa People's Organization, Namibia fighting for its independence. They're taken in little planes, flown out to sea, and their suffocating bodies are thrown into the sea to be eaten by the sharks. There's a terrible internationalism amongst killers and assassins. In Argentina, this is what was done. You not only destroy somebody, you disappear. The word disappear now becomes an active verb. You disappear the bodies. The trial judge says, but that happened in Namibia, not in South Africa. I can't hear a conspiracy charge conspiracy that took place in South Africa to kill somebody abroad. I'm quashing the charges. I'm not hearing it. It went to the Court of Appeal. The Court of Appeal were very angry with the way the state had prepared the documents. They threw out the whole case. It came to us. For different reasons, we decided there was a constitutional case. In my case, I felt the war crimes dimension completely outweighed the technical defects in the papers, and that there was a duty to prosecute in circumstances like that. And I wrote, and I quoted from Kasesi, and tried to get the theme of these horrendous war crimes into our jurisprudential debate. But the judgment that I wrote ended up by saying that the fact that he is charged and should be prosecuted or stand trial on acts that, if proved, are truly horrendous, in no way diminishes his right to a fair trial. If anything, it becomes even more important when you want to separate out, I'm paraphrasing a little bit now what I said, separate out the objectives and intentions of those who wish to destroy the rule of law and the democratic order, to separate out their way of doing things from the way of doing things of a democratic state. If anything, it's even more important that the principles of a fair trial apply. And it ended up by saying, and this was one of those moments of revelation. You're not sitting down and thinking. There's this book, Blink, How to Think Without Thinking. I discovered I was doing that, and it was Ruth Bader Ginsburg who pointed me to the book. I'd be lying inert in the bathtub, and a phrase, an idea would come to me, just unbidden. Of course, it's the result of weeks of threshing around and working in the area, but suddenly that just idea, fully formed, with lovely language, comes to me. And the idea that came to me in that way, unbidden but powerful, was that it would appear the duty to prosecute people guilty of horrendous actions, war crimes on the one hand, and the right to a fair trial are in contradiction with each other. There is a certain tension there. But I said they both spring from the same foundation, and that is respect for human dignity. Respect for human dignity means you don't allow impunity for atrocious actions. Respect for human dignity means you don't punish somebody without a fair trial. So in that sense, they are not conflicting. In that sense, they have that common foundation, and the idea is to maintain the common foundation in dealing with the tension between the two. We had another case called Kaunda, mercenaries who had been captured in Harare in a plane on their way to Equatorial Guinea, where they wanted to deal with the president. The case became famous internationally because Mark Thatcher, the son of Margaret Thatcher, was the financier, not for the event in itself. And the family of these mercenaries came pouring into the court, and they were begging the Constitutional Court, save our husbands, our lovers, our sons, our brothers, from being tortured and being put to death. It was so ironical, and yet they were human beings caring about people close to them. They didn't ask any questions. They were happy to receive the money. They didn't mind their lovers being killers. And you couldn't get a greater violation of the rule of law than that. It's going to overthrow a government, not even in your own country. We decided we couldn't apply our Bill of Rights to Zimbabwe or to Equatorial Guinea. It applies to South Africa. But we said there were some principles of customary international law which were binding on our foreign affairs people to do what they could. There was no duty to provide diplomatic protection because a South African citizen was in dire straits abroad. There was a right of consular access, that was all. But there was a duty in terms of the principles of customary international law which apply to interpreting our constitution and the rights of South African citizens to prevent South Africans, wherever they are, from being tortured or subjected to an unfair trial. And then we left it to government to decide whether to send a gunboat or write a letter or make a phone call or a protest. That would be up to them. I commented during the hearing that people go into a lion's den and they're surprised to find a lion there. But that wasn't the tenor of the judgment that I wrote. And the judgment I wrote was the Constitution, the Constitution, the Constitution. Whoever they are, whatever they've done, it's even more important when you're dealing with people who are violating the very ethos of the Constitution to apply constitutional principles. The final case, and I'll end with this, Mr. Mohammed did something so horrible. He helped with the organizing a bomb in the U.S. Embassy in Dar es Salaam. About 20 Americans killed, 40 Tanzanians. Came to Cape Town, he was 21, 22, worked as a pastry chef. Apparently a very good, very quiet pastry chef. Under an assumed name. The FBI were waiting for him. And they had his picture, not his name. They pounced. South African immigration people were thrilled to be working with the FBI. And the next thing, rendition, and he's flying to America. The owner of the bakery didn't know what's going on. He said, I had a lawyer for him. They said, he doesn't get a lawyer, he's an illegal immigrant. Went to the High Court. High Court said, he was here illegally, he doesn't have any rights. He's gone. He had no rights. It came to the Constitutional Court. We said it was absolutely correct that he be sent to face trial in the United States of America. Absolutely correct. But it should have been done properly. In Germany, someone who belonged to the same group was extradited following extradition proceedings. We said the fact that the crime was horrible did not deny him the right to counsel. Any decisions he had to make had to be based on informed understanding of his legal rights. And we said the most important substantive aspect was that our court had declared capital punishment to be inconsistent with the values of our new democracy and our Bill of Rights. And before he was handed over to face trial, an assurance should have been got from the American government that if found guilty, he would not be executed. In the case of the person in Germany, that assurance was given. But we, just that country down in Southern Africa, trying to follow the rule of law and constitutionalism and so on, all of that ignored. And what's interesting about the decision there, it was by the court. 11 judges. My colleagues hadn't been blown up, they hadn't been tortured, they hadn't been to jail, they hadn't been in exile. Lori Ackerman had been a judge under apartheid. He was deeply motivated in everything he did by his Christian beliefs. Influenced philosophically by Immanuel Kant, and human dignity was at the center of everything that he wrote, and he's just written a book about human dignity. I, coming from a secular, international, millenarian, socialist world of the unity of all the working people and the oppressed people throughout the world, human dignity is at the core of everything. We reached that platform following completely different routes, but however we started, whatever motivated us, we were in sync with our Constitution, the values of our Constitution. And so it was a unanimous decision. Speaking in very firm terms, we couldn't get him back to have the process all over again. It was too late to get this demand from the American government, but we sent the decision, our decision, to the trial judge, hoping that it would reach the jury. The jury eventually split 7-5, I'm not sure which way. That was in August 2001. If it had been 3 months later, I'm not sure that the jury would have split. But the point was not simply for the Americans to understand our values, it was to tell South Africans, you don't hand over people to be tortured or to be executed in another country. You extradite them, that's part of international law, it's important that we do that, but you don't submit somebody to something that would violate our Constitution. Thank you.
This lecture was recorded at the Yale Law School on January 26, 2010.